Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. We've got a big old mashup of old and new things today, and I'm not talking about Matt Burslow and Matt Jones. Sorry.
Which one of us? We're the same age.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm the fresh young voice then, aren't I, in this trio. How are we both doing? Yeah, you good?
Not too bad, thank you, Simon.
Good. Nice. You're headed out for doing something quite fun next week, aren't you?
Yeah, I think I should probably not tell people that until I come back. Oh. I'm not going to spoil it.
But you are
I'm very looking forward to it.
To say the least. Mm-hmm. We've got, like I said, we've got a big old mashup of things today. We've got old and new. We've got games that are, over 20 years old. Games that are days old. We've got films that are 50 years old. We've got films that haven't even come out yet. That's the sort of thing we do here. Let's just kick it off, I think, with the most important thing we need to cover, and it is, what is your favorite source, Matt Jones?
I did think about this after the episode. Yeah. If you've never had okonomiyaki sauce before, really good. If you like an okonomiyaki, it's like a pancake that's like a savory one. You can have cabbage and bacon in it, really good. But put okonomiyaki sauce on a bacon sandwich, it is fantastic. It is my go-to now.
There we go. That is a little hot tip there from all the way from Japan.
Which I don't like to go on about it, but I have been before.
Right, you've seen a film, Matt, that I'm very excited about, that I want to see very much, but I can't just yet, and that is Alex Garland's Civil War. What's this all about?
It's all right. I think Alex Garland's one of those directors where, like, even if not all of it hits, I will still go and see everything that he produces. I think I enjoyed watching Men, but I do think it's one of his weakest ones.
I didn't like. Yeah, I know what you mean. It was intriguing, but I think it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Something that he really likes to play around with, actually might be a little bit of a spoiler for this film, but I won't talk about it too much, but it's like this dismantling of what it means to be, like, you know, important. And that is, like, at the very end of Men, I really love that, like, I'm just going to spoil Men, sorry, but there's, like, this like, 10-minute-long transformation scene with this, like, gross dude, and, like, by the end of it, the main character's just bored. It's like, it should be a really horrifying thing that's happening, and she's just like, when is this going
to
end?
Kind of reflected my experience with the film, to be fair.
Totally. But I really like that. So even if it's like, I don't know, it's just got interesting ideas, even if it doesn't always see it the full way through. And Civil War, I really loved. I think we gave it an 8, which I think is totally accurate. There's some moments that I think are really clever, some moments that I think are kind of a little dull, but ultimately really cool. It's about America. Which is a country to the west of the globe.
Yes. Never, well, depending where you are.
Yeah. No, it's always to the west.
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, no, just depends. In terms of the mapping that we have done in the, like, modern era, yes, certainly.
Are we really going to discuss the history of the globe?
It's difficult to suggest what actual west is on a spherical object.
Culturally west. Yes.
I think, yeah, Matt, yeah, are you like a Mercator projection guy for maps? Are you big on those, like, you know, Cardiff, have you ever heard about the fact that the map is wrong? The countries are the wrong sizes. It's
weird.
Well,
the thing is, a lot of people, they look at that map and they go, wow, the world's flat, when actually it's round. I don't know if you knew this. It's round.
I'm going to drop some bombs here, though. That, anyway. I want to talk about the map. Okay, it's the wrong size for everything, because the map
size
is
of America is not what it looks like on a globe. Yeah, it's all, nothing like it.
I know what you mean. And the oceans to the... Yeah, they're not quite, you know.
And Greenland is like 7 times bigger than it actually is, because it's about like shipping routes. So we should use a different map. We should use a more
don't
like...
Don't get me started on Kamchatka. And let's get into Risk. Yeah. But anyway, this is a fictionalized America in this film where there's a new civil war going on. It's not about I'm not going to say the year because I'll get it wrong. Over 250 years ago. Anyway.
It's a modern civil war. And so it's set in like current day and it uses like that framing as a like, oh, if you could imagine it happening in America, like this is exactly what happens everywhere else, but it gives a American lens to it. I think really well acted. There's a like breakout performance by I think we really like him in this show, Jesse Plemons. He's in it for a couple scenes. It's got these really good bits of like pockets of not fighting happening, like just because a civil war is going on over pretty much the entirety of America doesn't mean that everybody's being affected by it in the same routes. And those moments are really, really cool. I think check this out as soon as you get an opportunity.
Yeah.
I did
mean 150 years, not 250 years before I get an email telling me I'm thinking of the Revolutionary War and not the Civil War. Anyway, sorry.
My question about this is because I've only seen the trailers for it and I haven't really delved too deep on it. Basically, waiting for you to tell me, Matt. Is it a film that is based on the current culture war and what the potential evolution of it could be, or is it more fictionalized in that?
Thankfully, it strays from being really deliberate about what the causes of anything are. It has moments where it says that, like, there's a great line that, like, the reporters are in a car and they're talking about the questions that they would ask the president if they got the opportunity to. And they like softball it and they were like, oh, so when you decided to go into your third term, what were the decisions that led you to that sort of thing? Like, you realize that it might be as a consequence of the decisions that the president is making, but also it might be that the president has been led to be making those decisions based on other factors.
I think that's what intrigues me about this film so much, is that it is kind of a war film, but it's not seen through like the soldiers' eyes, right? It's seen through these war journalist eyes, which is like a different angle, right? You're not, you know, it's not your typical going on a mission necessarily. It's trying to navigate it, and it kind of, I am intrigued, like, is there, I don't want to ask too much in case it's a spoiler, but like, it's odd for Alex Garland to do something that isn't at all sci-fi related. Like, historically, whether it's 28 Days Later, Sunshine that you wrote, or Dread, or like Ex Machina, which I rewatched recently and really loved this time around. Annihilation, I think, is unbelievably good. Although it's not, I know it's not to everyone's taste. Like, this is just a very grounded film. Like, does he?
No sci-fi at all. No.
Yeah, he just pulls it off. Yeah, I suppose. There we go.
In terms of thematically, then, is it very much about war as opposed to cause of war?
Yeah, I think it is totally about the way that we perceive like events. Like, I think it's about like people's drive to do certain things. Like, I think that's the core of this. It's like, why is anybody doing anything that they're doing is absolutely the core of this one.
Nice. Cool. It's not out for another 2 weeks, but I really do want to see this. It's in IMAX as well, which...
So at our screening, Alex Garland's there at the front and he just gives a very short little chat. And he says, like, when we were filming this, we didn't even know these cameras could do IMAX. So here you go.
I do like Alex Garland. We've spoken to him a few years ago. He's very, like, just matter-of-factly, just like, yeah, like, to the point. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to watching this and I hope I enjoy it. I was trying to work out how to segue from Civil War to the new Princess Peach.
Strong female leads.
Has there ever been a civil war in the Mushroom Kingdom?
Constantly, isn't it? Right?
Yeah, yeah. Is that civil war? I don't know. Princess Peach, you've been playing that one as well, Matt. I kind of, every time I looked at this game, I thought, oh, it looks fun enough. Nothing there to really go like you need to play this game? Is there, like, what is the sell factor of this
game
for you?
It is too simple, I think, is the thing that you need to take away from this one. I think that it's got quite a lot of heart. There are moments in this where, like, the thing that happens in it is that you're Princess Peach, you go into a new level, you'll get a new power, and then that power interacts with the level in some interesting way. But you only really, you press a button that isn't jump in order to pretty much do everything in it. And it means that it's mostly about interacting with the environment. And then, like, if you see an enemy, you press a button. In some games, that really works. And for this one, it's just a little bit too simplistic. There really isn't enough going on. But despite that, there are moments where that it has a real, like, a lack of mechanical flourish also means that, like, the moments where the animation is really good stand out. There are bits where, if you're playing as, like, Ninja Peach, there are lots of really interesting incidental animation stuff where if you, like, are underwater, she'll have a reed that she pokes out. And if you're in the grass, she'll hold up, like, pictures of grass. And then if you're back against a wall, then she'll be holding up a, like, cloth that looks like the, like, the texture behind her. And this is only for, like, the span of a very small level where this happens, and yet there's a lot of detail in it. And the fact that it's mechanically, like, underbaked makes all of that be like, oh, they put a lot of effort into making Peach look really cool when she's doing this stuff.
That's kind of like the Nintendo, like, thing of, like, yeah, giving you one thing for a level, right, and you never use it again. But, like, those are great if, like, in Mario games, well, more traditional, like, Mario games, where those things are each fantastic and they all are, like, equally good and they keep the momentum going. I'm just, like, wondering if this game, like, Nintendo games as a rule kind of get, like, painted just with this, oh, they're family games just because their presentation more than anything, whereas a lot of, like, Mario games, stuff like that, can get very difficult and, like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily give it to a kid. Is this one, do you think, more catered
I think
to
for
children?
Mario specifically, it's as difficult as you want to make it. For most of them, even the 2D and 3D, for this one, it is just simple on its face. And I think that will frustrate quite a lot of people. I think you'll get through it in an afternoon.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's one for me necessarily, but it does. You know, it's always good to. It sounds like it's one for the kids.
Yeah,
maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, I think for your first game ever, I think you could do this. I think there are moments where there's a little bit of timing that you need to do, but that's when, you know, you give Dad the controller for that one.
I was going to say, yeah, is there a platform? Is it, like, a good, like entry level, like, you know, entry point to other Mario games?
Yeah, I could see this genuinely being your first game ever, and I don't think you'd have a problem with it.
There we go. You got any interest in this one, Matt?
Not at all.
There we go. I haven't really been playing in any new games. Like, I'm working my way through Midnight Suns again, which I'm loving it. I'm getting there with
you going
it,
on dates with Blade?
I'm trying to I've done, like, all the mysteries around except in the, like, around the grounds of the mansion, except for one which requires, like, summoning a meteor essentially, and I need to go stargazing, but it's not every night the stargazing option isn't there. I'm just like, let me go stargazing with, I don't know, Spider-Man or something. Like, just let me do it. I love Wolverine in that game. I use him as much as possible. It's just, Wolverine is just, how can you not like Wolverine as a character? He's just so good, isn't he? But yeah, Midnight Suns is good if you didn't know about that. And I've put over 50 hours into Balatro now.
Oh God, I should pull up my time as well. I bet it's more.
I'm trying to do every challenge now, and some of those are.
I'm also trying
difficult.
To do every challenge. Yeah, I've had 67 hours with Balatro.
Oh, good.
Oh God,
but yeah,
I think it's making the game of the year list. Like,
oh, it's in my top few at the moment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it kind of means I've just been watching a lot of films. One of those is actually a new film. I'll get onto the old ones later, don't worry, because I do like the old films. But new one I watched is Drive Away Dolls. Have either of you seen Drive Away Dolls?
I haven't, no.
I have not, no.
It is a new film from Ethan Coen, one half of the Coen brothers. And you can kind of tell pretty quickly this is it's not a Coen brothers film because it's only one of them, but it's got that tone of, like,
They didn't make all these movies beforehand if they didn't like making this type of movie.
Exactly. It's like, they're kind of like, when I think of, like, a Coen brothers film, it's like a crime caper with a lot of comedy. That's kind of what, like, if you told me to just, like, you know, write an outline of a Coen brothers film, that's what it'd be. And this is what this is. It's only like an hour and 20 minutes as well, this film, which is good. It stars Margaret Qualley as this... She's doing a mad, like, I think it's a Texan accent she's doing in this film, or is it Tennessee? I can't remember. it's a weird mishmash of, and I'm not, by no means an expert on Southern American accents, but it's a very entertaining accent. I'm not sure it's too accurate. But it's her and Geraldine Viswanathan, who's going on this sort of road trip, and they are both gay, and like Margaret Qualley's character is much more outgoing and kind of like sexually free, and Geraldine's character is much more reserved, and it's kind of like her trying to take her on this trip to get her out of her shell, essentially. But in true Coen Brothers fashion, the car they rent for this trip has links to some crimes that are going on, and I'll leave it at that. And they find something in the boot one day, which kind of changes the course of the film. It's no longer like, it threatens to, for the first 20 minutes, be some sort of like sex comedy road trip, and it turns into more of a crime caper with some very funny cameos and just like just weirdness going on. It's quite out there. I liked it, didn't love it. It's a I don't think I've seen a film that has dildos central to the plot more than this, and I'll just leave it at that. It's not like I'm making it sound like really like a really sexual film. It's actually not. It has like a handful of scenes and like stuff, but I enjoyed it. It's quite funny and it's breezy, only an hour and 20 minutes.
I was trying to think of another movie that's got a dildo that's really central to the plot, and the only one I can think of is Burn After Reading. So maybe the Coen brothers have got something going
on. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I would ask people to write in, but we probably
let's leave that one.
Yeah, there's a lot of... Well, yeah. Anyway, we'll move on from that topic of discussion. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's by no means... It won't make my, like, top 10 at the end of the year list by no means, but it's a bit of fun, an hour and 20 minutes as well. I'd check out Drive.
How does it rate
Dolls
among? Obviously, it's not a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah,
but is it? Do you think not having the two together is less of a magic recipe?
Slightly, yeah. This feels like it. Almost feels like a when you're watching it. It's not like a full budget. It almost feels like it's a fun side project he wanted to do. If you know what I mean, it wouldn't be. It's not near the bottom of the Coen brothers. Like, they've made a lot of films, and to be fair, I do think a lot of them are very, very good. So, you know, it'd be near at the bottom end of that list, but that still makes it a good film, I think. But yeah, I'd recommend it if you're looking. Not maybe not one to watch with the parents or the grandparents. Maybe let's leave it at that. But yeah, I enjoyed it. What have we got next? Matt, you've been going back in time and playing through the original Metal Gear Solid trilogy. How have you been finding that?
Yeah, very good. So
good games, aren't they?
Yeah, you could say so. I've got a spotty history with Metal Gear Solid. So when I was a kid, I played Metal Gear Solid 2. That was the and I played it in its substance form. That was what that one was called, wasn't it? And I never played Metal Gear Solid 3, and then I played 4 when I had a PlayStation 3, then obviously played Ground Zeroes when that came out, and as an adult I've played actually not all of MGS5, but I've played probably about a third of it. And while I definitely know that I like these games, I've just never kind of filled in the blanks. I can remember getting the HD remasters of 2 and 3, but I had them on my PS Vita, and those sticks are not conductive to very, very precise aiming, which you tend to have to do in games where if you don't hit things in the head, you end up in a lot of sticky situations. So this is kind of like, with the Master Collection having come out last year, this is my first go at kind of A, revisiting ones I have played as an adult, and B, playing through particularly 1 and 3 properly, because my only I got as far as like doing the Virtuous mission in 3 on the Vita, and then just I got to the bit, I think you fight then Ocelot fairly quickly after the Virtuous mission, and it was just an impossibility on those sticks for me. So
it's weird, we're kind of the inverse. I've played 1 and 3, but not 2.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
So 2's my favourite, so get
that here's
done.
Here's my kind of like coverage where I've got. So obviously, anybody that wanted to kind of do this journey after me, do be aware that the controls... They're not impossible, but it's definitely, it's a very archaic control system. And the more you go through it and the more complex the games become, the more challenging that control system becomes. I actually think Metal Gear Solid 1 is pretty easy to play these days, even though it has old controls, because it doesn't ever ask you to do anything super complex. Metal Gear Solid 3, meanwhile, which I'm playing at the moment, asks quite a lot more of you, and so therefore, even though it has very similar controls, it's a little bit more challenging. But I think Metal Gear Solid 1 is basically a little masterpiece. I can't believe how well that game has aged. Structurally, the Shadow Moses kind of facility reminds me a lot of the police station for Resident Evil 2, and I love Resi 2. It's probably my favorite out of the Resi games. And any game that allows you to do that kind of like rotation through a space and revisiting areas, getting key cards that unlock new doors and reconfigure that space, absolutely my jam. And this game does that in spades. But I think the main thing I really like about that game is it's so badly written that it is basically Dark Place. And I am never going to forget like the quote of, "Do you think love can bloom on a battlefield?" It is so good. But because the game is basically sneak into a facility and defeat a bunch of freaks, it works so well.
Yeah.
It is like all of the enemies are so delightfully designed. Every boss fight is a really well thought out piece of work. Starting with kind of the Ocelot fight, where essentially you're just running in circles around a room with someone strapped to a bomb in the middle. But going up to kind of like the Metal Gear fight at the end is really, really cool. I love fighting Liquid on the roof. But I just love how goofy, silly that game is. Whilst also, it's really interesting just how well written so many of those characters are, despite the fact that the writing itself is bad. There are amazing character arcs with characters that you never meet because they're just on your codec. Like, I think Naomi Hunter's arc through that game is really fascinating and is probably, out of now having played almost all of the mainline Metal Gear, she's probably the best written female character in the game.
Yeah, it's been a real tragedy to that arc, if I remember right.
So I loved one. It was really interesting revisiting two as an adult, because I can remember loving two as a kid, and I still do think it's really good. I think the idea to have play a Snake on the tanker at the start and then switch to Raiden is still an absolute great bait and switch. Mm-hmm. The stealth mechanics in 2 are such a step up over 1. It actually feels like a stealth game while still maintaining the structure of 1, of this, like, you have a big environment and you're moving from sector to sector and key cards are unlocking new things. The only disappointment I'd say with 2 is that the boss fights are nowhere near on the level of 1 is. I think the Fat Man fight, we had a conversation about fights
come out recently,
last year.
Hasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think the Fat Man fight is really good, and I think all the other ones are kind of a bit disappointing.
The Fat Man one's okay.
Like, I haven't played Metal Gear Solid 2, but the only two things I really know about it are the bait and switch, and I've watched the Fat Man fight. So those are my two reference points.
I really like the Fat Man fight because it feels very kind of like puzzly in the way that I think a lot of the best Metal Gear boss fights are. You're kind of like dealing with this like mad bomber on roller skates rolling around an area, and you're having to go and defuse all these bombs he's putting down whilst also trying to fight him. Whereas I found kind of like the fight with Vamp, the fight with Fortune, the fight with Olga,
like the Olga fight, because I think it's experimental. Like,
yeah,
it's really
cool. So the Olga fight I thought was like pretty good for your, because it's the first kind of fight in the game, right, where it's you're stuck in position and she's using cover in interesting ways. But I also really think it kind of built to the Solidus fight, which I'm not crazy about, and I'm not crazy about the Vamp fight either.
It's just a bunch of lads scrapping on a roof, actually, to be honest.
But in general, I still do think Metal Gear Solid 2 is a fantastic game, and I really love kind of like both Tanker and Big Shell as environments. Mm-hmm. Metal Gear Solid 3 is such an interesting then step from where those games were. And to use the Resident Evil analogy, I do think that kind of like Metal Gear Solid 3 is like how Resident Evil 4 kind of reinvented what Resi could be, because it still has elements of what that series is, but there's a lot more idea of like pushing linear progression forward. You've got these wider areas, like how Resi has the village, then the castle, then the island. It's almost got that sort of structure in that it's kind of like you go through kind of like the forest sort of area and then into the mountains, and then you get to the facility at the other end. So yeah, there's kind of definite similarities I can see between those two, but it is so much more advanced as a stealth game. There's so much more going on in that, which does mean that it requires a lot more
on
of
your
you.
Head.
I've not got the ability to put a crocodile on my head yet. I've only just reached the kind of end. Well, I'm assuming the facility at the end. It's where I've been told that, like, I'm going to have to destroy the Shagahod.
Not the boss fight, the end.
So I did the end boss fight yesterday, but I think kind of like, I'm assuming where I'm now at, I've gone all the way through the mountains.
You'll have Shagahod. I love the Shagahod scene. So that is like full like James Bond stuff.
Well, I love how Bond this is. And, you know, that also brings in it slightly more awkward things in that kind of like the writing of this game is better, but because it's set in like the 60s, it comes from Japan that has a different culture about writing women, and the Bond sort of elements mean that Ava as a character is, oh boy, I'm playing this with my partner and that's an awkward thing to constantly, every time she's unzipping that suit and getting her boobies out and it's like, God damn it, woman. There's a lot of Kojima horniness in there. But in general, you can really see the development of his cinematic taste here. The cutscenes are really well put together, even though kind of like visual fidelity isn't where we get to in 5 yet. But it does really feel like you are playing this kind of like 60s Bond infused with kind of Mission Impossible, with a bit of kind of like Heart of Darkness to a certain degree, with that jungle sort of element. But yeah, the most recent boss fight I've done is the end, which is where I'll stop banging on about Metal Gear Solid. But I think the end boss fight is tremendous. The thing I really like about 3 that I didn't get out of 2 is, again, this is a story about a bunch of freaks that you've got to go in and fight. And they've all been really good boss fights so far. I was lesser fond of the pain boss fight. I think that's a little bit underwhelming. I think the fear is excellent.
I like the fear,
And is just such a character.
And the end, and the final, I don't know if you know what the final boss fight of this game is, but that is also just an incredible.
Have you done the sorrow or just the yet setting? As well?
No, so okay. I know kind of the rough path that this game's taken. It's difficult to not know about this when you are a games journalist. I've not got to him. I've still got like Volgrin, the Sorrow, and like there's one more of them, plus the big kind of concluding sections. The end as a boss fight, absolutely tremendous in terms of, I know that there's the whole thing where if you save and turn off your PlayStation for 7 days or wind the clock on, that the end will just die while he's waiting
of old
for
age,
you.
Yeah.
but so I played it as the sniper battle. And that is astonishing.
That's probably the more fun way to do it.
Yeah, but the thing is, it took me about an hour and a quarter to do, and I've not played a game that forces you into a sniper battle where it's like, no, you just have to keep your head down and seek him out. And I was doing it the way, you know, Metal Gear Solid 3 introduces the idea that you can even non-lethally take these bosses out. It's almost slightly Dishonored in that way, right? And you get
it is quite immersive, Metal Gear 3.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's obviously why I'm taking so much joy out of it. But the thing I really like about this is you get different rewards if you take them out non-lethally. And I knew that the reward for killing taking out the end non-lethally is you get his tranquilizer sniper rifle, which I really wanted. You know, I can't use the sniper rifle on this guy, so I have to get like real close up to him. So I spend like an hour like following him around and sneaking up on him in the grass and holding him up and shooting him. And anyway, it gets to the point where he's got a tiny, tiny sliver of health left and I haven't been able to find him. And I eventually spot him across the entire other side of the map by his sniper rifle glint. And then I the only thing I could shoot him with is a pistol. I managed to line up that pistol shot and shoot him from across the entire length of the map and get him in the head and get that kind of like knockout. And that was a real punch the air moment.
Yeah. He tried to recreate that with Quiet in 5. I think that sort of sniper battle when you first meet her, and it didn't, I don't actually dislike that fight too much, but it didn't quite capture it, the
yeah, like I have played that fight even though I've not finished Metal Gear Solid 5, but my memories of that is it felt more like a traditional video game sniper battle than what this did.
Yeah,
I think, correct me if I'm wrong on this, if you can sneak up on him too and hold him up, he gives you his camo, which is like, but I can't imagine actually doing that.
And of course, you can kill him like hours earlier if you happen to have the sniper.
They do that so well. Like, I think one of the things that Metal Gear does really well is use of like the UI and stuff like that. And when you get into the area where they've got the end, sorry for spoiling parts of these bits for anybody that hasn't played this, but I hope I'm just encouraging you to play it. There's a bit where you see like a cutscene with him in a wheelchair and they're just explaining like, oh, he's the grandfather of snipering, basically. And he's just like this old man built to snipe. But his health bar comes up in the top corner. And that's kind of like the trigger. It's like, could I kill him? If I got a weapon that I could have got that shot off with, I absolutely would have tried it. But at the time, I didn't. But yeah, I love all of these games. I've got a real newfound adoration for them. I knew that I liked them, but this has been a real visit to them.
Also, you can eat his parrot.
Really?
Yeah.
Excellent.
The parrot. I want to play these again now. Like, is the Master Collection, is it in a good way? Because I know when it launched, people weren't too happy with it.
I wouldn't say it's a brilliant setup, but there is nothing that's like for example, when I was first playing Metal Gear Solid 1, I watched a couple of videos on the internet just to... It doesn't really teach you anything, right? So I wanted kind of like a 101 course just to get me through. And seeing what people have done with that by just emulating it on PC and being able to upscale it, it is like... It's pretty shit that Konami didn't do any of that. And it does look like playing a PS1 game. There is real soft edges to everything in that game. And, you know, the Metal Gear Solid 2 and 3 are the Blue Point HD remasters with very little else done to them. So it is like more or less playing them on the original consoles. I'm fine with that. I did pay like £45 for these, so I would have liked more done. But for someone who is... This has been my gateway to actually experience two of these games for the first time, or mostly for the first time. And so I'm willing to deal with a subpar remaster for that experience.
I think I'm going to, but we've got the 4-day weekend. I'm thinking about doing it now. I was even thinking about it on Switch, but I think I'll go on PlayStation.
So again, with the Switch, I hate the analog sticks on the Switch. And I think the aiming system in Metal Gear Solid is already quite convoluted. There have been a lot of fights where I've had a little bit of a tantrum because trying to get off good shots with the setup. So that's my hope for this Metal Gear Solid Delta remake of Snake Eater. It's just being able to aim by holding down left trigger and then pulling right trigger to fire the gun.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
You know what? I've played two of those games before and you've inspired me to want to play them again. So, if you haven't played them,
fantastic.
Metal Gear Solid before, check it out. Good game. Who knew?
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
Another kind of blast from the 90s, Matt. X-Men are back. And the new show I've heard, I don't really have much of a kind of emotional connection to that series. I know for a lot of people it's what they grew up on. I don't know if that's the case with you, but how are these new episodes of X-Men?
I definitely caught it on telly when it was on. And I remember really enjoying it, but not like it wasn't one of my absolute go-tos, right? Like, you know, it wouldn't be like, you know, I need to wake up early to be able to, I don't even know when it was on, but like, yeah, whenever I saw it on TV, I would watch, but I never really cared. This one I think is, it's just really cool in a way that, a lot of like either superhero or even like Disney, like Marvel stuff hasn't done in a while. Like there's a moment in that first episode where Cyclops, I think I talked about this in a meeting, so you'll have to forgive me, but he like, because his power isn't shooting a laser, he's shooting like basically he's throwing a punch with his eyes. He uses his laser to like move himself. Like he like shoots the ground and it pushes him into position. And it's just, I'd never thought about Cyclops doing that before. And it was a moment where it was like, oh, people that are working on this show have just thought about what the coolest thing to have somebody do moment to moment could be. Like, every episode so far has had two characters combine their power in a weird way that you probably wouldn't have thought about before. And like, I'm imagining that's going to be every episode is just like a weird little combo team up that, yeah, just unexpected.
Is it written like a kind of like a kid's morning show, or is it kind of written more, do you think, more for people who have the nostalgia and grew up on this and it's a slightly more adult version?
It's tough to say because I think it was kind of always like this, but that might be a little bit rose-tinted. Like X-Men conceptually was always about like a parallel for civil rights at the time it was written. And so it, without having those plots, just wouldn't be this show. And it is still very much that now. And so I wonder whether or not that adult nature is something that they've bled into this, or whether or not it's like maybe you just weren't picking up on it as a kid. But I definitely am now.
Because they've called it X-Men 97, right? But it is just a complete... It's not a continuation, right?
It's a new story. No, it's a full-on continuation.
I thought it was a brand new story.
No, it's as if the last season just picked up where it left off.
Oh, well, there we go. Because that's the question I was going to ask, because I never really watched the original a great deal. Like, can you just pick it up from this point and you won't be completely...
Absolutely could. Actually, to its own fault, I think that the first episode is too full of exposition. Like, they introduce a character to this world and it basically has Jubilee for basically like 5 minutes saying like, here's how the world works. Okay. It's quite dull. It improves significantly after that point.
Nice. Yeah, there we go. Mm-hmm. Check it out if you want more X-Men. I've got so many things to watch. And
yeah, I'm sorry to add another thing on your pile. I will say this of the show as well. I was watching it on my computer because my partner was busy in the living room. And something so cool happened in the third episode that I was like, I've got to stop watching this now so I can watch it on the big TV. I can't just actually watch a tiny screen version of this.
I went into this podcast thinking I'll spend another few days watching 70s films and playing Midnight Suns, and now I'm going to play through the whole Metal Gear trilogy and watch X-Men.
There's not many episodes of X-Men out yet. There's only three, so you got a chance.
I mentioned films from the 70s. I like films, okay, and I've been going on last week I've been going on a mad like mid to late 70s early 80s like thriller kick. I don't know what's caused this, but like, I've watched like five like thrillers that I just hadn't seen before that I knew I kind of should. First up in that, I actually mentioned this on the Lost podcast last week, but you didn't get to hear it, so let's pretend. Matt P, you're on that one. Pretend you've never heard me talk about Sorcerer before. William Friedkin's Sorcerer, which at the time was like a colossal critical and commercial bomb. It came out exactly the same time as Star Wars did, which of course just absolutely cannibalized anything in cinemas.
What?
I know, yeah, this thing that kind of... I don't know if it's around these days or not, but for like... months after Star Wars came out, it practically cannibalized anything that came out in cinemas, so you were doomed. And yeah, Sorcerer, which is William Friedkin's, despite its name, completely grounded thriller about four men who find themselves through different ways, all in South America, kind of in exile, hiding, because they've done things have happened in their life to cause them to basically run away from where they're from. And that it's kind of, for the first half an hour, it's a, like a foreign language film about four men and like what's going wrong in their life. And then halfway through, it changes into this like, it's not really a road trip. They're tasked with transporting this really delicate dynamite across the country through like rainforest, across bridge, through horrible weather. And it becomes this really tense thriller of these four men from completely different places having to work together to transport this dynamite. Has a couple of ridiculously intense scenes, one involving a bridge, one involving just a fallen like tree that like sound really like dull, but they're just, the tension in this film is really good and I really enjoyed it. Check out Sorcerer if you can, from William Friedkin, who this was his, I don't think it was his follow-up, it was shortly after The Exorcist, which was obviously one of the biggest commercial successes when that came out, and this completely flopped when it came out after. But yeah, Sorcerer, check out that one. Have either of you seen Night Moves from 1975? Okay, Night Moves is a Gene Hackman thriller where he plays a private detective and he's tasked with finding a woman's missing daughter who's gone missing. She's 16 and she's gone missing in Hollywood, and it kind of takes him down to Florida as well, and it's like interlinked thing of sort of like Hollywood crime. There's some stuff to do with some stuntmen and stuff like that, but also some weird like insurance issues. It's kind of a little bit like Chinatown meets The Nice Guys, and I'm pretty sure when Shane Black made The Nice Guys with Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, he watched this film because it's very similar.
You also have The Fall Guy coming out soon, so you could probably write a nice article that's like, oh, you want to know where they got the idea for this?
Exactly. I thought Night Moves, I gave Sorcerer 4.5 stars on Letterboxd, I gave Night Moves a 4-star. I thought it was very good. Only an hour and a half if you want a good thriller set in the 70s with Gene Hackman doing his stuff. And who doesn't like Gene Hackman? Next up, you guys seen Rolling Thunder?
Nope.
Okay, from 1977, Rolling Thunder. The reason I watched this is it's one of Quentin Tarantino's favourite films. And for his next film, which I think at the moment is called The Movie Critic, it's heavily rumoured he's basically reshooting scenes from this film to put in it, much like he did with The Great Escape in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'll have that reference point. This is just like a classic revenge thriller story. It's a major in the army comes back from Vietnam, obviously has the trauma of that, and goes back to his home, starts living his life again until one day his home is invaded and some terrible things happen. And the rest of the film is about him going to Mexico, essentially, and hunting down these people that did this to him. It's a very 70s, 80s just revenge thriller. I get 3.5 stars. It's good. But yeah, would I thoroughly recommend Rolling Thunder? No. If you're big into Tarantino and look forward to his film coming out, then it probably would be helpful to watch.
It sounds like a homework. Quentin Tarantino watch. Absolutely.
Yeah. it's okay. A film I hadn't seen before that I absolutely loved is, have you seen Blowout?
No.
This is from 1981. Okay. It's Brian De Palma's thriller with John Travolta, who is a sound recordist for films. So he he finds the sounds for films and kind of does Foley and just like goes out in the world.
Are you just watching a lot of films about films, Cardi?
Those are my favourite sort of films, to be fair.
Right.
But this one, it's not really about films. So John Travolta is a sound recordist for films. So one day he's just walking through the park and he's trying to get like some good like just Atmos sound for his film. And it's late at night, and then suddenly out of nowhere, this car just basically drives off the road and into this lake. And he's recorded the audio of this, and he rescues the woman from the car. And it kind of, he listens, obviously the police question him, and there's obviously something deeper going on here, and a kind of a deeper conspiracy unravels. It's got John Lithgow playing a really creepy, sort of like hired assassin in this film. And it's really, really good. And it's called Blowout because, you know, is the sound of the blowout on the tire of the car he's listening to on the recording, or is it a gunshot? Those are like the trying to work that out. And it has a really good ending, and he's kind of, the film starts out with him trying to find the perfect scream, and they're kind of making, like, he works for like quite a bad movie studio making like knockoff Halloween like slasher films basically, and there's quite a funny section where they just start, this film is like the opening of Halloween, like it's a first person track through like a college dorm room and following a killer, and it cuts to a shower where someone's about to get killed, and the actual actress in the film's scream is just the most pathetic scream you've ever heard. So, yeah, I really enjoyed Blowout. That'd be my biggest recommendation. So check out Blowout. I'll quickly mention Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is an Australian film from 1975. If you haven't seen that, it's based on like an old Australian novel. So really,
imagine if
weird...
that was the one that I had seen out of all of this.
It's a very famous film.
Yo, Picnic at Hanging Rock. Let's go.
It's a really like weird, ethereal sort of horror-ish. It's hard to define. It's about like it's set in 1900 Australia, and it's about a group of schoolgirls who go on a school trip to this place called Hanging Rock, and some of them don't make it back, and it's all about the mystery of what happened at this at Hanging Rock, basically. And yeah, really enjoyed that. But yeah, if I was mentioned, recommend any of those, Sorcerer and Blowout, those are the two. Blowout is very, very good. But yeah, there you go. There's some backlog for you to get to, because
it's not like there's nothing else to watch at the minute.
Exactly. Don't watch X-Men. Watch Blowout. Watch John Travolta trying to solve crimes.
I like how there's like a brand new TV show out from the people that made Game of Thrones, and none of us have spoken about
that.
Has
anyone watched Freebody Pop?
I've watched the first episode. It didn't grip me.
I just don't know. I'm just not in the mood for TV at the moment. I'm in a film mood. I don't know if you go through those phases where it's like, I want to be told a story today and I want that story to finish.
I've basically been in a games mood for about 2 years. Like, I've watched so little over the last couple of years.
Fair enough. Anyway, let me know if you watch Blowout. What more there is to say. IGN _ UK feedback at IGN.com is where you can do that. We, of course, want to know what your favourite sources are. I think one topic we talked about last week was films that you watched when you were a kid that you loved, but then subsequently realised everyone thought was shit, like Bicentennial Man or Return to Oz. Did you have one for that, Matt? Did you have a kid's film you love?
Yeah, I watched, I think it was Aladdin 2 a lot. It was one of the later Aladdin films at the very least. And I don't know if I'd seen the original Aladdin. yep. I think also one of the Home Alones too, like Home Alone 4. And not the original Home Alone. Yeah.
Wow, there we go. Yeah.
It's not even got Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone 4.
Only 1 and 2 exist in my eyes. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, there are no Home Alone films. Anyway, Matt, you've got the first. Matt P, that is. You've got the first feedback for us this week.
This one is from David Trevino, who says, "So, my favourite sauce is Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce."
Can we cut in the audio of
the end of
Facebook?
This podcast is just going to be Zuckerberg. There's no music in this podcast. It is just Zuckerberg talking about Sweet Baby Ray's.
But of course, being from Texas, I use a variety of hot sauces. Verde is my favorite salsa. Interesting. Also, lately, I have been loving Korean barbecue marinade and sauce. I've been using it as a marinade on lots of meats.
I know this is a bit local, but if anybody goes to Chinatown in London, you should go to Pochawa Grill. It's a little bit pricey, but it's real good.
Mm-hmm. I will keep it in mind.
On another note, do you all watch the Harley Quinn animated series? Man, that is funny stuff and seems to be getting crazy with each season. The Valentine's special in season 3 was wild. Giant Bane running around and boinking all the buildings. I love how they portray Bane and Gordon. Anyway, have a great weekend, David. Now, the funny thing here is that this email has combined two factors which went into a joke I made on Twitter years ago.
Oh, really?
Which is, there's an excellent bit, I think it's in season 1 of Harley Quinn, which I do think is a fantastic, I'm not up to date on it, but I think it's basically the best thing that DC have done on TV for a very long time.
Okay.
But there's a bit where Harley Quinn is complaining that she's basically got nothing to do at the weekend. And Bane is like, "Oh, I'm going to Black Manta's
beach." Do the voice.
He says something like, "Oh, I'm going to Black Manta's beach party. He's smoking a pork joint." And the thing is then I edited that together in a little video, which then immediately cut to the reveal of Black Manta being Zuckerberg talking all about how he's smoking his meats. So both in one podcast email.
I'm smoking these delicious
meats. I didn't eat a meat until I was already a man.
God. I'm still just thinking about this Zuckerberg video. It's just... It's so he's not human, is he? I really hope if Fincher does ever make The Social Network 2 that he puts the Sweet Baby Ray's video in there, like gets Jesse Eisenberg to do it, like recreate it.
It's so... It feels like, in retrospect, I mean, the movie cuts off at exactly the right point, but there's so much more that happened to that story that's so interesting.
You can make, like, three more films since then. It'll largely be him in court. It'd be a courtroom drama. Well, it must have been the first one's a deposition, isn't it, I suppose? But yeah. God, yeah, good stuff. Other Matt, new email. Read, please. I've forgotten how to speak.
This email's from Jordan Green, who says, "Hi all, a film I watched as a lad and to this day I enjoy is 13th Warrior, the ultimate Antonio Banderas film. I found the cannibal people terrifying and I thought the film was sick." Can't tell which kind of sick that means. Might be disgusting, might be good. Could it be was both, only really. When I rewatched it and Wikipedia'd it recently, I found it was a total flop. The eventual reappraisal has yet to happen, but I still have faith. Cardi, you seen 13th Warrior?
I have not seen 13th Warrior, I'm afraid.
Let's put it on the list.
I can't comment. Yeah, yeah. Add it to my... It's 90s, bit too big for me.
Yeah, it wasn't made in the 70s. Yeah. So Jordan also says, as of writing, I'm ping-ponging back and forth between Dragon's Dogma 2 and Rise of the Ronin. Strikes me that we're seeing a lot of JRPGs recently, though what that actually means seems to be changing, as they're clearly gunning for some of the mainstream Western market share. There seem to be two camps in an attempt at westernization, either the Ubisoft-alike or the uncompromising hardcore. Just interested to hear your guys' take. Which do you think will win out? Do they end up just coexisting? As always, thanks for the pod, respect the sea and graver diggers, etc., etc. Jordan.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, when I think of the RPGs that have come out this year, like, I think of Rebirth. That does kind of do a bit of the Ubisoft stuff with the towers, but it don't, you know, it doesn't ever feel like a chore in the same way, right? There's not.
I think people have
to do
very different ideas on that, because I love Rebirth, and the more I've thought on and sat on it, the more I like it. And I think a lot of the things that I like about it is stuff that people don't, because, like, people really don't like the mini games, whereas I kind of think the mini games are essential to it. And
I love them, yeah.
But obviously this example here is Rise of the Ronin, which is much more Ubisoft in its design than this is. I sort of think that they will end up coexisting on the premise of that's just games, right? Some things need to go for the more kind of open appeal, and homogenization, as terrible as it is, just happens, especially in an industry that's costing more and more money. I do think that when we talk about the ones that people remember, though, it will be the ones that just don't compromise and do go for the hardcore, because that's what we got out of FromSoft, right? There doesn't seem to... I don't understand how FromSoft has become what it is, because it doesn't make sense that Elden Ring can be one of the biggest selling games, and yet it is, and it's important. And I also don't understand how Zelda is what it is now. How has Zelda turned from what is a particularly, you know, like a brilliant but fairly standard adventure-style genre game into this massive open world that basically doesn't give you any instruction whatsoever. It's just like, go on, kind of go and find some fun. It's out there for you. And the fact that these have become massive, I think, does point to the idea that if you've got the budget and you can do it right, these big, uncompromising, hardcore, you know, in inverted commas, concepts will win out. Because I don't think any of us will be talking about Rise of the Ronin in 3 months.
Probably not.
I think it shows that that's the... poor game. Not that necessarily the more Ubisoft way is tired, it can still be very fun if done right, I think. But the, like, Souls, like, it's still fresher, right? There's still people that are making good versions of that and doing it well, whether it be like Lies of P last year that had their own take on it. And feel like, you know, these trends come and go, right? Like 15 years ago, everyone was trying to make GTA games, right?
Yeah.
And
you never see those anymore, right? When was the last GTA clone you saw?
Exactly.
Saints Row, but you know that crashed and burned
badly.
It's really interesting as well that like this year, I think I've played more traditional JRPGs than I have like any other year too. Like we've had Yakuza Like a Dragon, we've had Unicorn Overlord, which is fantastic, and Persona Reload as well, which are like not going for any of these. Like you know, it's not trying to do the hardcore or the westernization. Yakuza, you could say pretty westernized, but like they're still the standard, and all of them are doing incredibly well. Like all of them sold great. I don't actually know about Unicorn Overlord, but I live to hope.
There's also been kind of like, I know that Granblue Fantasy, which is obviously the original version of that, is much more of an MMO kind of mobile game, right? And then this was their more traditional JRPG kind of take on it. And then Tales of Arise kind of felt like it was a big breakout for the Tales series as kind of more of a mainstream thing, even though that is essentially, you know, it's like a Final Fantasy game, right? Like it's a fairly traditional JRPG.
Yeah.
So those things definitely seem to be working. And I do think that in general, kind of Japanese game design is so well appreciated kind of in the West at the moment that these games are going to find a lot of success. I think it's a massive shame really for Rise of the Ronin that it is so Ubisoft. Like when I'm not a big fan of Team Ninja's games at all, but the other games that they do make are Team Ninja games as opposed to this, which is like a watered down version, I guess, of Team Ninja.
Yeah, it's not.
It didn't work for me.
No, I enjoy it.
So email in if you're playing Eluden Chronicle.
Exactly. Got Metaphor Refund Tales.
Oh god, I can't wait. Have they released a date yet for it? Actually,
I don't think so. I think it's just.
Oh, give me it
this year, right? I think they said this year. Yeah, I want to play that one. I do wonder what the next trend would be. Like normally, I'd think like when you have such a big success like Baldur's Gate 3, like people be like, right, how do we make games like that? But that is such a difficult thing to make.
It's interesting that we've obviously over this past week has seen we've had members of the press get hold of Judas, of which we Ryan McCaffrey for us was one of those, and listening to what Ken Levine talks about that in terms of this narrative Lego, there's obviously a lot of Hades in there, and the idea that Judas is apparently kind of this rogue-like shooter, but it sounds more like the Deathloop approach to roguelike more than a pure roguelike, but also has this idea that kind of like the game builds around you depending on who you side. There's these three kind of central figures that you can work with, and if you work with one of them, it reconfigures the story around that, and the other characters can then turn up and, you know, because you've pissed them off, they'll take things away from you or they'll ruin stealth for you and stuff like that. And that has, I can see a bit of Baldur's Gate in that is a RPG that was built to be so reactive to everything you do. And obviously Baldur's Gate is much more through the fact that they just simply wrote 100 outcomes to any sort of storyline, right? So that whatever you did, there would generally be something that could respond to you. I think whilst that is impossible to expect out of many studios that don't have kind of like the resources of 450 creators over 6-7 years of development, I think what we will see going forward is more attempts to create genuine reactivity rather than fake reactivity. Yeah, and, you know, we might see an example of that in Judas, and then that might inspire other people. And, you know, there's it stands to reason that Judas might be terrible. Like, it is quite an ambitious idea, but in practice, it might actually just feel quite repetitive because there might be the same procedurally bits of story constantly being used over and over again, and that might turn out not very good, and that sort of thing requires the authoredness of Baldur's Gate. But I think in general, if people don't take something away from the reactivity of Baldur's Gate and find ways to do it on different budgets at different scales, that would be a shame.
I can't wait for Judas, and just like you said, I feel like it could, like, you could have two wildly different playthroughs. Like, I think reviews for that game will be so wildly interesting and different, because like you're going to basically be playing a completely different game.
If it works, as he says,
yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, like, it kind of reminds me of when we first played Remnant 2. Mm-hmm. Like, our first like 2 hours each, we played separately. We were in completely different places, having completely different. Like, mine was a lot better than yours by all accounts.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, and that's the thing, right? Is that from what we know of Judas, it's not just the storyline that, you know, that has lots of these individual small components of story that get reconfigured with other bits of story depending on what you've done, but also the ship of the Mayflower that you play on is also procedurally generated. There are distinct locations, which I imagine have authored sections of them, but then they can change like a roguelike does.
Yeah.
Which brings me, like you say, brings you to a game like Remnant, in which you can be in vastly different interpretations of those worlds depending on where you go. I ultimately fell off Remnant. I didn't all that much like it, which, again, these sort of things make me very interested in Judas, but I do fear for Judas that the ambition doesn't quite match what the experience is. But that is a game that I am hugely interested in, and I do recommend going out and listening to these very, very long podcasts that now exist of it if you're interested in listening to a man who might be mad and might not be able to make this vision happen, but it is nonetheless very interesting from a game design perspective
to
listen.
It's just good to see someone like him be able to do it, right? And being allowed to do it.
Well,
and
helps when you've had that success in your past, right? Someone will give you a load of money to try and create another BioShock, won't they?
Exactly. But we've seen a lot of examples the last few years of very well-storied game developers not making the games necessarily that they'd want to. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but yeah, who knows? You just could fall flat. It could be one of the best things you've ever played. Who knows at this stage? I can't wait to play it, that's for sure. We have one more email, don't we? And that is for me to read from Chris Mutton. He says, "Hi, everyone. I hope you're all starting to enjoy the longer days with a bit more sunshine when you leave work." I mean, I don't ever leave work, so I work from home, but I do. I do like to have a walk. Have you guys tried walking?
Occasionally, yeah. It's pretty good.
I've written in a couple of times before, but just wanted to speak on last week's pod. It made me laugh hearing you speak about Dragon's Dogma 2 and the fact that you could play for hours, meet a creature in the wild, and get wiped, losing all that progress. Whilst in real life, you just spent a couple of hours recording a podcast for the equipment not to work properly, setting you back a couple of hours and having to work through the podcast topics all again. It was very impressive, by the way, as it could have easily been speaking about it, all the subjects again. Thank you very much. I didn't even clock that. It's very funny that we basically just had a real life salt podcast.
How did you feel about it? I imagine it was quite frustrating.
I got over it. But yeah, I thought, do you know what? The second one was also good, so that's good. It would have been bad if we'd recalled it the second time and I was like, that wasn't very good, was it? But I thought it was still good, so there we go. But anyway, it just made Chris think about when games imitate life and when randomly there's a crossover into real life or other media forms. It's quite a wide question, but do you have any memorable moments in games or full games where you find the experience pops up in day-to-day life? Mine is when I was riding a moped on holiday in the Philippines during the sunset, and for some reason, I started singing Far Away from Red Dead 1, and when you're riding the horse to Mexico. Love all the work you put into the pods, so thank you. Chris from near Milton Keynes. I think we've maybe spoken about this before, but I think it's more about like being somewhere, like whether it's being in Osaka from Yakuza or being in LA from GTA 5 and knowing where you are, but I have a really one. This is probably something that loads of people who've played Football Manager have. Like, there was a period, I want to say between 2010 to 2014, where half the players I bought for Spurs on Football Manager, like 6 months later, we'd buy in real life, and I felt like they were actually watching me, like as a scout, and being like, that, you know. I mean, not that anyone, you know, a few people knew who Christian Eriksen was, for example, when he was at Ajax, but I was like, I'm signing, and I made it happen. But yeah, I don't know about you guys. Like, sometimes I like close my eyes and I do see like puzzle shapes in my mind when I try and sleep. It's probably not a good sign, is it? But yeah. You guys got any examples of this?
I do not, I'm afraid, or at least none that come to mind.
Yeah, trying to think of anything deeper than just like going to Yokohama and then just being like, "Oh, I know that one. I know that. Yeah. I know the Chinatown there."
You haven't encountered any tree frogs recently while playing Metal Gear Solid 3?
No, but sometimes you've got to eat one, haven't you?
Some days you go through the rain.
Yeah.
Have you done the ladder?
Yeah.
What a moment.
I mean, as they say, what a thrill.
Yeah. I'm going to play Metal Gear 3. I don't know what... No, I'm going to start from one and go through.
I recommend starting from one because I tell you what, I'm sorry I keep banging on about Metal Gear Solid, but it is a very exciting series. But I have no idea how I understood anything that was happening in two as a kid because it is so reliant on your knowledge from Metal Gear Solid 1.
Even like aside from that, a lot of the topics that it's bringing up, it's largely about the way that data platforms can control the way that you understand like the information in front of you.
And I was a 14-year-old trying to play that.
The more important thing, like no one really had experienced it unless you were hanging out on BBS boards in Japan. Like that is the only way that you would have the thought of like, oh, the information that's in, like coming across my feed isn't necessarily indicative of what's happening in real life.
Yeah. the whole kind of like storyline of obviously kind of like that brings up the idea of the Patriots and kind of like who's in control and stuff like that. That is a conspiracy theory as old as time, right? But the very specific things about what is effectively discussing over saturation of stuff on the internet and how that changes people's perspectives and how the message has to be controlled for the good of the people because too much information is just going to essentially explode their tiny minds. It felt so prescient, the fact that that was built way before we were had, you know, the ability to just open our phones and just have a shitload of information downloaded basically straight into our eyeballs, of which half of it is misinformation.
There we go. Well, this was the Metal Gear Solid podcast. If you don't care about Metal Gear Solid, I'm sorry, but you know, it's worth talking about, isn't it? You're going to go to 4 and 5? Or are you waiting for those to re-release?
I can technically go to Ground Zeroes and then 5, right? Because it's a continuation of 3, even though Peace Walker, I think, comes in between them.
Mm-hmm.
But that would, for me to do 4, then Peace Walker, then Ground Zeroes 5 will require me, I assume, 4 and Peace Walker are what's in Master Collection Volume 2. Because if we've got a Volume 1, there's surely a Volume 2.
Imagine they re-release Acid instead of
You should go to Death Stranding. Go play that.
Well, so I do. I am building up to basically get to Death Stranding because I haven't played Death Stranding and I loved the trailer for Death Stranding 2. So I do want to get there. I will play 4. I didn't like 4. I will point out that. That was one that I really didn't like. But I do want to replay it as part of my adult reappraisal. But to replay it at the moment would mean going trekking all the way to my parents and getting my PlayStation 3 and bringing it back. I'm just going to wait for them to re-release it because surely they will at this point.
That is the smart thing to do. The PS3, the original one, is the size of a Metal Gear, so lugging that back will be.
I've got the slim. I don't have the original.
Oh, lucky! I've still the only PS3 I've got is still like the original big chunky one. Yeah, it's so big. I get it out once every 2 years to play Rock Band and Guitar Hero, and that's it. Good stuff. IGN_UK feedback at, is that right? That was right, wasn't it? IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com. Let us know, maybe some answers to Chris's question there about anything that's happening in a game that's been imitated in real life. That'll be fun to read out. In the meantime, why don't we listen to Mark Zuckerberg smoke some meats? Goodbye.
Hey everyone, we are live from my backyard where I am smoking a brisket and some ribs. I'm making meats now. Smoking these meats here. Our little meat smoking. It's smoking. So I'm the meat chef. Yeah, someone asked me, do I smoke meat? Smoking meat. Smoking these meats. Smoking meats earlier in the day. Smoking these meats. Just set the charcoal up and you set the wood chips up, and then smoking meats, grilling meats, good smoky flavor. Smoke a brisket for like 12 hours. You smoke lemon chicken, smoke salmon, you'll love it. Bison sirloin, ribs and sausage, so I'm looking forward to that.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.